Hey there, listeners. This is Justin with a quick note before today's episode. We're going to be hosting a live seminar. It's going to be held by video on June 19th. That's Wednesday, June 19th. It'll be 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. It's going to be 90 minutes. This first seminar is hosted by Amgen. We're going to have three different team members with three different roles, with three different backgrounds, all veterans on the live panel. And just like on the show, I'm going to do 45 minutes of Q&A with the three of them. And then we're going to take 45 minutes and open it up to the audience to answer any and all questions that you have. If you have any interest whatsoever in about Amgen, about the biotech and medical services industry, about functional roles that are universal across every industry, I'd really encourage you to join. I would love to see you there, add some faces to some names, and have your participation. I think you're going to learn a lot, and we're very, very excited to kick this off. And also very grateful for Amgen's support, because by sponsoring this panel, they're helping us expand our work over here at Beyond the Uniform. And all of this is 100% free for you to join. So costs nothing. You can register through our newsletter, or look for a link on the site. Hope to see you there. Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Nasiri, and my goal is to challenge and support military veterans to reach their peak potential in their civilian career. Today's episode number 270 with the IVMF's Dr. Nick Armstrong.
This idea that, like, if you had this job or this occupation in the military, well, you're stuck with that. That's going to be the boundaries or limitations to, like, your future career path in civilian life, and nothing could be farther from the truth. We know that more than half folks that don't want to do anything related to what they did in the service. They want to do something different.
Nick's decision to go back to education led him to working in national security policy and ultimately his role with research and execution at the IVMF. Nick never thought he would pursue a PhD, but his positive experiences with professors and mentors led him to dive in. In this episode, we talk about the guilt that veterans face when they leave the military while their colleagues continue to serve. We talk about the 25,000 people, that's right, 25,000, that the IVMF helps every single year, and how important it is for veterans to be a better informed consumer. We also talk about how the biggest challenge veterans face is not just employment, it's navigating benefits and services after their military service. As always, at beyonduniform.org, you'll find show notes for this episode with links to everything we discuss. You'll also find over 269 other episodes just like this to help you identify, pursue, and obtain your ideal post-military career path. Special thanks to username Can't Get Enough Thank You, who back in December of 2016 wrote on iTunes, "Love the respect and curiosity that comes from Justin as he interviews his guests. This show is helpful to those who are aspiring to become a better version of themselves." Thank you so much. You nailed what we're trying to do, and really appreciate you and the 110 others who have left positive reviews on iTunes. It really helps get the show out to more veterans who can benefit from these free and on-demand episodes. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Nick. Joining me today in Syracuse, New York is Nick Armstrong. Nick, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Hey, thanks, Justin. Glad to be here.
So for listeners, Nick is the Senior Director for Research and Evaluation at the Institute for Veterans and Military Families, or the IVMF, at Syracuse University. He started out at West Point, after which he served in the U.S. Army for 8 years as an operation officer with time in Bosnia and Iraq. After his military service, he worked as a research fellow at the Institute for National Security and Counterterrorism prior to joining Syracuse University. Nick earned an interdisciplinary PhD and MPA from the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University, both focused on public management and international security. So Nick, to start things off, could you take us through when you left the Army? What was that first transition like, that first job search like, and what ultimately led you to the Institute for National Security and Counterterrorism?
Sure, happy to. So I got out. I came off active duty in 2007. Three tours at that point, Bosnia, Iraq, Afghanistan, was, you know, trying to look to that career shift. So I'd actually pursued engineering for my undergrad degree at West Point, and I took a couple interviews with some local engineering firms, and it just didn't quite seem, it just didn't quite feel right. Actually, one of them actually extended an offer, but you know, part of me was, you know, feeling this, you know, sense of still wanting to serve. Felt like you know, I had a great time in my experience, like in the Army, but it was if you recall at that point in time, you know, we were kind of caught up in, you know, back-to-back deployments and just needed a bit of a slowdown, you know, from a family standpoint, and, you know, just trying to sort out, like, what's the next career path look like. So at first I was, like, looking at engineering jobs, just didn't quite fit. And then, you know, I was thinking, oh, do I go back and get an MBA, go back to school? And so I was looking around upstate New York. So at that point, I was transitioning out of Fort Drum, New York. And, you know, through some connections, I heard about the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. Didn't really know much about it, to be honest with you, at that point, but did some background research on it. And then I visited there and recognized that, you know, this great school of public affairs, you know, it's is a great public administration program. So I initially thought, like, oh, okay, well, how about I'll just, you know, I've been good at school. I felt good on a college campus. So, like, I'll just go back to school and sort of figure it out from there for a year. And so I started the MPA program about 4 months after separating in 2007. And, you know, while there, decided to sort of focus my work in national security policy. And there's this this research center called the Institute for National Security and Counterterrorism, where I was fortunate enough to land a research assistantship while pursuing my studies there, and connected with the director of the institute at the time and founder. His name is Professor Bill Banks. Really well-respected legal scholar in the national security, basically defined the national security law field, and just kind of fell under his wing, and was just there at the right time with a stroke of luck. They received a big gift to expand the institute while I was pursuing my master's degree. And so then they you know, decided to offer me a full-time research role there. So I transitioned into a research fellow's job, which is kind of one of those academic titles. You're like, what's a fellow, you know? But at the end of the day, it's basically working on active research projects. You're basically a project manager. And so that's kind of an easy pickup from where you left off in the military, because, like, we manage projects and, you know, had some background in national security. So while I was there, so I worked for INSCIT, is the nickname for the institute. I focused my work in security force assistance. And while working there, I decided to keep going to school. Never in a million years did I, you know, consider pursuing a PhD. But, you know, just being exposed to it, and then having a couple great professors, Bill Banks, and then another faculty member there by the name of Dave Van Slyke, who's now the dean of the Maxwell School. Who are both my mentors, you know, basically said, hey, why don't you think about, you know, pursuing a PhD on the side, and as another stroke of luck, the new GI Bill had kicked in at that point in time around 2009, so I had a little additional funding to keep going, and, you know, pursued my work around our the NATO training mission in Afghanistan, and that's what I did my dissertation research on.
That's awesome. What I love about your story, and I think that's I see that a fair bit, is it's kind of like you didn't actually have this master plan. You kind of made one decision that led to gaining knowledge and insight, and through those professors that you really admired and those mentors that you had, you started to think about this PhD, and it seems like it's a path that's led you to where you're at, but it wasn't this master plan from the outset.
Yeah, I'd like to say that it was, but you know, a PhD was never in the cards. Never thought of myself as an academic type, but really found a unique landing spot here at Syracuse. I mean, there's a huge history that we can dive into with respect to the university's connection to the broader military community, and I had no idea of its deep connection and long history until I got here. But really, it was just sort of like that, you know, an initial just sort of fumbling around, but really kind of coming back to a recognition that, you know, I could go out and pursue an MBA and go into the private sector, but, you know, at least initially there was really that, you know, especially we were, you know, you get caught up in those deployments, you know, in the mid-2000s, like it was at that point in time, we were in the middle of the surge, you know, you feel like, oh man, did I make the right decision to get out, like in the middle of a war, like you know, your buddies are still, you know, in the grind. And you know, almost a sense of guilt, like I'm here sitting on a university campus, but like wanting and longing to find a renewed sense of purpose and like a new way to, you know, to serve and give back. And fortunately, I was able to find a great home and you know, some opportunities presented to me to be able to pursue that.
That's great. And I appreciate your saying that, because you're hitting on two points that come up a lot. One is that lack of purpose that a lot of people experience, of feeling really fulfilled and having a clear mission while in the military. And then most people I talk to long for that. They long for some higher purpose. And then I also really appreciate your being candid about that guilt. And I know that I've heard that from others as well, like the guilt of, here I am in a safe and secure environment, here I am doing something, and you know, there are others out there still serving. I think it's really real, and it's good for listeners to hear that, to anticipate that guilt, and realize they're not alone in that can be its own web to untangle, to figure out how to live with that and how to approach that. And I would, my hope, you know, for you and for everyone, is that you know, you have done your service, you've done a great duty to the country, and to not feel that guilt, and not to feel guilt if you find something else that you enjoy, or you find something that's a better fit for your family after your military service.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think for me, it took years to kind of move past that, but then to recognize, like, hey, look, you know, like there are more ways to continue to serve and serve your nation, serve your country, than just being in the uniform. But, you know, those first couple of years, they were tough. I was really sort of just kind of finding my way. I mean, and then, you know, dealing with the fact that, you know, like, you've got this great opportunity, I'm just, like, you might as well take advantage of it, but at the same time, like, it's almost like this weird, it's like a messed up, it's just messed up, like, like, am I really truly deserving of this opportunity when others are, you know, suffering or dealing with other hardship, you know?
And it's, you know, it's exciting for me to think, in the 260 plus interviews preceding this, to see men and women who have done great things in the military, but then gone on to do great things afterwards. And I have seen the impact that these people have in terms of being employers, being founders of companies, doing research like you're doing, you know, just making the world a better place, even though they're not in uniform anymore. And I just personally think that the best thing that we can do for our country and for the world is to do something that we're excited about, something that we feel alive doing. And so I love the authenticity you're bringing to this, of just recognizing that guilt is real, And then also just kind of recognizing the value to our country of going on to do something that's a good fit for your family and good fit for yourself.
Yep. Yep.
What about Syracuse and the IVMF? What led you there?
Yeah, so that's another just wild, unexpected story. So while I was working with the National Security Institute and pursuing my PhD, in the middle of that, my current boss, our vice chancellor, who I think you had on the program, Mike Haney, Air Force officer, taught at the Air Force Academy, left service to become an entrepreneurship professor. Came here in the mid-2000s, like right around the time I started grad school. And while I was going to school and then started my studies, he created a boot camp for veterans focused on small business ownership. And this was his project, being an academic and entrepreneurship professor and seeing folks come back, some with severe injuries and sort of looking for their renewed sense of purpose. You know, he created this boot camp for veterans, and with really no intention of turning it into what it is today. But just with this early success of that, other universities quickly saw the value of that and wanted to do the same thing and say, "Hey, Mike, how can I do that?" And so one thing led to another that, that program is now a consortium, a university consortium. So almost 10 universities operate that boot camp program, on their campuses. And then that just started a domino of other, the Small Business Administration wanting to create other entrepreneurship training programs, other funders wanting to create programs focused on career training. And so fast forward from 2006 to 2011, there was an opportunity that Mike saw to create an academic institute focused on vets and military families. And so his whole thing is, contrast to where I was at, I was focused in a National Security and Counterterrorism Institute. You know, mid-2000s, most leading research, D1 research universities had some type of existing or new center or academic unit focused in national security studies, counterterrorism studies, or homeland security. By 2010, very few, very, very, like single digits of major universities have had any type of institute focused on the needs of veterans and military families. And so he saw this as with the early success of some programs that we're delivering, is like, how can we be entrepreneurs on a university campus and leverage all of the human capital and talent that sits on a university campus, and not just faculty, but students even, to leverage that in a way to be outward facing, to help serve the nation. And so he really saw this as an opportunity to create something unique and differentiated. In that process, as I was finishing up my doctoral studies, they stood up the IVMF. Really around these training programs and services, and they stood it up, separate and distinct from any college or school that sits on our university campus. And so that's almost unheard of, because most academic centers, fall within like a school, like a business school or a policy school, or and have that sort of disciplinary focus. The whole purpose behind this was to create something that you can draw and pull and build teams from different disciplines to be able to create innovative programs versus research. But at some point, we had to grow up and actually, form the more traditional arm of the institute. And so I joined the team around 2014 after finishing up my PhD. Did a total pivot from national security policy and, you know, embedded advising and security force assistance and like that type of focused work to helping to build out and grow the really what amounts to the insights arm of the institute. So at that point in time, we've had the boot camp program that I mentioned was, you know, approaching eight, 9 years old. We had another career preparation program that we were launching, another community-based community engagement effort, helping communities stand up these coordinated care networks across the country. Programs are growing and scaling up, and so I joined the team, and you know, we started doing more traditional research projects, but only traditional in the sense that it's social science research. I'd say it's not traditional in the sense of like we're purposely doing research and asking questions that help to inform and drive the programs that we deliver. So we have employment and career preparation programs. So we're looking at employment numbers. We're working with employers on leading practices for, you know, hiring, entrepreneurship. We're looking at barriers to veterans and military spouses who want to launch and grow their small businesses. And then on the community side, we're partnering with other organizations to look at what does right look like in the nonprofit space. You know, 40,000 nonprofits that serve this country across the country. You know, what does right look like in serving this population? So asking those types of questions that can then, you know, how we can turn right around and hand those off to my teammates that are working inside of our programs to help them provide better services. And then even as, you know, I mentioned the insights arm of the institute, so we started out doing these research projects, and those continue, certainly. But, you know, as we've done some of this work, particularly around, I mentioned, what does right look like in the nonprofit space? And so we're delivering programs on a national scale now, almost 25,000 transitioning service members, vets, or military spouses go through our programs each year. To get to that number, you know, and through our research, like we've really had to make internal, you know, sort of strategic focus and investment in measurement and evaluation. And that came directly out of some of our research that, you know, nonprofit service providers often don't always have the resources because they're, you know, sometimes constrained by grants and funding streams to be able to measure their outcomes and be able to truly evaluate their outcomes, their impact, and even be able to assess, you know, programmatic improvement in quality over time. And so we made a purposeful investment to help, you know, grow our team internally to not only just do independent research projects, but also start to look internally across our portfolio programs about how we think about our outcomes, and how do we measure them. You know, when we were growing up without really this I would say purposeful vision of being sort of this national multi-program institute. You know, we'd get a grant and build a program, and then we'd get another, you know, somebody else comes with another idea about another program. Oh, that's a good idea. There is a recognized need for that. Let's build that program. And through that process, you know, we're collecting data on these programs. But there, like, we quickly found ourselves like, well, we're building these programs in isolation of each other. Like, how do we tell the broader story about IBMF and our reach and the impact that we're having in the lives of others across this like scaling portfolio of initiatives and research even? And so we brought on a number of folks on our data scientists and analysts that we're embedding as a direct service to the different program managers across our team. And even more recently, as I mentioned, this this challenge of being able to tell the enterprise story, developing data management capability. And we've had great fortune of having some exceptional partners come alongside us, like the company SAS, which is a global leader in data analytics software and data management, providing us pro bono support in sort of building data warehouses and data visualizations and sort of upskilling our own team to be able to do this work, not just for us, but, also in partnership with other nonprofits. So it's really been an incredible journey that I never envisioned. But it's just being able to see opportunity and being able to transform that in ways that help others. And, it's just been an awesome ride. I have, this is the best job I could possibly imagine.
That's awesome. That's a rarity in both military veterans and just normal civilian friends. I think it's rare to find someone who's really found a job and career and calling that's aligned with who they are. So that's awesome to hear. And for listeners, I wanted to point out in the show notes, there's two other episodes related to the IVMF. In 212, like Nick talked about, we talked to Dr. Michael Haney about founding the IVMF. And then in episode 232, we talked to Maureen Casey, and she had a wealth of knowledge to share about some of IVMF's research. Another thing, it's just incredible that you've had 25,000 vets go through each year. That's and their spouses. That's really incredible. And I love the data-driven approach that you're taking to all of this. You outlined a really wide array of broad-reaching topics that IVMF is addressing, and it's great that you're in all of those using data. And one of the things that I wanted to ask about is that, you are just steeped in this. I'm sure that you're stewing in this day in, day out. You're doing presentations left and right and research left and right. And, we have an audience right now of some people who are still on active duty who are thinking about getting out of the military. We've got an audience of people who are out of the military and thinking now of how to optimize their career, how to really take the next career move that's going to bring them fulfillment. And I'm curious, based on all the work that you're doing, giving you a little bit of a blank check here, what would you want them to know? What's most top of mind for you right now about what you're working on or what might benefit listeners?
Sure. So I think one of the biggest, we get the opportunity to do these big research studies. We'll ask dozens of questions of folks in the community, whether they're in transition or after. We collect a lot of data, but oftentimes, you'll do this huge study that you think is groundbreaking, and there'll be one nugget of one question that people just latch onto. And I think it's been sort of a really driving, an insight that has driven our approach as an institute. But I think it's also important for to your question and to the listeners about this idea of navigation. So we know that if you look at employment statistics, for example, the latest annual report's about to be dropped by the Department of Labor. It's going to show the lowest veteran unemployment rate in history, but we know that there are challenges beyond that. We did a survey with Google about 2015, huge laundry list, survey, really trying to get an understanding of what folks' barriers were to transitioning into higher education. And we asked a broad question about what was your biggest challenge in transition? And, we gave them the laundry list of, everything you'd expect from financial difficulties, employment, access of health services, engaging in my community, et cetera. And we thought employment would be number one on the list. And in fact, it was number two. Number one on the list was navigating benefits and services. So I mentioned earlier, 40,000 nonprofits that serve this community. Those are the nonprofits that have this that designate a special code in their 990 status that they're a charity or a nonprofit serving the veterans. That doesn't even include all the other, you know, general human health and human services and nonprofits that serve all Americans. So the biggest challenge we see folks facing are being able to navigate and to know who to turn to for what and when as they get out of service. And so that points directly back to the fact that, one, you know, that's informed our approach in helping to provide more seamless integration between our different programs and being able to understand that, you know, when folks have needs, it's rarely ever occurs in isolation. It's not just I need a job. It's I need a job and maybe housing assistance, or I need they happen in tandem. And so being able to recognize that, and then for those in transition of knowing that there are services out there to help navigate, and also to what another term that we throw around oftentimes is being a better informed consumer. At least when I was getting out in 2007, you know, TAP wasn't mandatory. I attended a couple briefings here and there. I'm like, I figured, oh well, I've got terminal leave. I'll figure it out then. Like, just, you know, check the block. Like, get me through these briefings. Now TAP, the transition assistance program, has gone through a ton of change since then and has improved, but still, you know, they're trying to make they passed recent legislation and it's about to be implemented to offer TAP transition GPS programming to service members. The rule was at 6 months prior to separation. Now it's being pushed further upstream to 12 months. And I would just encourage folks to do as much homework as they possibly can prior to separation and having a good plan in place, whether it's finding a job or you're going back to school, leveraging the GI Bill. I would also say for those that who are married, of include your spouse in as much as of those briefings and information sessions as you can, because that can also be a point of friction, you know, downstream as you take the uniform off of like not knowing what benefits and services may be available to help, whether it's an employment transition or, you know, finding the right school. There are all kinds of schools and programs that have become military friendly and you know, offering distance-based education that are highly reputable versus, you know, going to some of those that may be really more just targeting folks for their GI Bill benefits versus giving them like education or training of high value. One program that we deliver that sort of, you know, that was really designed for this very purpose of like being able to complement what is offered in TAP is called Onward to Opportunity, and this is the program that's it's really one of the it's one of our key drivers in that 25,000 number, in the sense that we're now working in and around 18 military communities across the country, supporting over 60 military installations. Basically working with the private sector to provide industry-specific and industry-recognized, in-demand career skills training with a direct pipeline to a pool of employers who have existing you know, programs in place to help recruit and attract veteran talent, you know, particularly in areas in the tech sector and in business management, HR. And then we also complement that with free, and this is all free to both the service member and the spouse, of being able to like arm them with this training and credentialing as they leave service, versus like having them to sort of, you know, figure it out when they land, whether it's you know, back home or in a new community after they leave the service.
That's great. I mean, it definitely resonates with me in that survey. It is so wild to think that the number one thing is not employment. It's just navigating those benefits and services. That's something I've heard from listeners is like, God, how do I sort through all of the different resources out there. So that's definitely matches my experience. And for listeners, I'll add a link to Onward to Opportunity in the show notes. I love that approach of taking that long view, training people well before they leave, rather than they get out and then they're kind of left on their own to fend for themselves and figure things out, in that completely unknown environment.
I mean, and another insight along those very lines too is, if you go back, 8 years ago, veteran unemployment was close to its peak around like 2011, 2012. And the employer, like if, for those of us who've kind of been along this ride now for half a decade or more, we've really seen a shift in like what's the conversation about, supporting vets, particularly around employment and economic opportunity and transition. The thinking back then, I mean, we were in all-out crisis mode. Veteran unemployment rate was 4 times the national average. And the, as you'd expect, the employer community responded, and the whole focus at that point was like, get veterans jobs. Like, how can we attract that talent? But I would say the conversation like has changed quite a bit in the years since then. I mean, we've obviously had an incredible economic recovery, which has been the key driver to that. And then also some of these major employers really stepping up with hiring commitments like the Veteran Jobs Mission, the U.S. Chambers, Hiring Our Heroes, KKR, some of the holding companies. There's been a lot of, large company efforts to be able to, figure out how to best capitalize and take advantage of understanding what's that business case of hiring a veteran, not just because it's like the nice or right thing to do, but it's actually like a value to a company, and that's been great. But now the conversation with veteran unemployment so low, and like with the research that's followed, just a cold approach of just plugging a vet in a job or even thinking about, and this ties to a myth that gets me worked up kind of on a soapbox, but this idea that like if you had this job or this occupation in the military, well, you're stuck with that. That's gonna be the boundaries or limitations to like your future career path in civilian life, and nothing could be farther from the truth. We know that more than half folks that don't want to do anything related to what they did in the service. They want to do something different. Sometimes that requires some additional training or education, which, there are programs and, some we offer and many other partners offer to help in that transition process. But I think there's been a mind shift, and a mind shift that we need to, help employers understand that, just because somebody did something, like there's not a one-for-one transfer. There are other skills that folks bring, and they also have the capabilities to learn and be there and they're trainable. I mean, the military is the nation's largest workforce development, training program, if you think about it. So you already have like a folks with a pre-designated set of skills just by virtue of being able to just being able to qualify for military service already sort of sets you apart from your average citizen. And so then it's like, what can you do to continue to transform folks so they're not just, plugged into the first job that may not be a good fit and may ultimately be bad for the employer because they figure out they're a bad fit and the vet leaves within the first year. And so like now they're stuck with like a bad retention rate and additional HR costs. How can we as a community think about on the one side, on the supply side, helping to prepare service members and spouses for careers, not just for that first job, but how to be, arming them with not just employment, but arming them with employability, like the ability to continuously learn. Like we know that the workforce is changing dramatically. like the skills that are that will be needed 5, 10 years from now. Like the data, just I talked about our story about data analytics. I didn't think we'd be building out a whole data analytics shop in addition to the research, but that's just the changing nature of the times. Like you have to be able to help prepare folks for their career, not just for that first job. And then on the flip side, with employers, of being able to help them understand how to recognize veteran talent, how to read resumes, how to coach them, how to put them to their best use in their company, of not just plugging them in a job, but recognizing that veterans may bring certain skill sets that may be a good fit for the business that may not be intuitive right off the top, like based on the resume. So, it's really working both sides of the coin to help make that transition as smooth as possible, but really setting folks up and being, for us, like being that partner for that veteran or that military spouse for their life, not just for the one-off training program or the one-off job.
I love that. I'd never thought of that as the military being this job training platform that's the largest in the country. And I love what you're saying about a career, not just the first job, and an employment, not employability. I think those are worthwhile missions. I think that's a testament to how far we've come with the unemployment rate much lower. Now it is more about not just let's get people in the door for their first job. Like, how can we train people to thrive and be happy and fulfilled in their post-service career? In addition to the onward to opportunity, how can listeners tap into this wealth of knowledge at the IVMF? Where would you direct them, or what resources would you point out to them?
Well, I would just direct them straight to our website. It's IVMF.syracuse.edu. But like I said, we've got a family of different programs, focused in career preparation. It's on the career preparation side. Onward to Opportunity, is open to all. It's not just for those in transition, though. We offer the bulk of our operations are focused in around installations, but military spouses are eligible to pursue the program at any point in time. Veterans can come back to that. We offer a distance-based version of that. We're starting to, push some of our operations into communities that have a heavy National Guard and Reserve presence that may not have that military installation nearby. Our whole suite of entrepreneurship training programs that we dub the arsenal. There's more than a half a dozen different programs focused on veteran business owners at different stages. And whether you're just starting out thinking like, hey, I think I want to be a business owner, to actually putting that in place, to like already having an established business and looking to grow, we offer different programs. The website just takes you through those different questions of like what you're looking for, and then if you're in a community and you're looking for services, like we're helping communities stitch together that web of nonprofit service providers in 16 other heavily populated veteran communities, and that program is called America Serves. So any one of those you can search for, and those should pop right up. Whether you're looking for navigation, you're looking for employment support, or entrepreneurship, and then of course our research is littered all over our website. We've got a publications tab, but you can search through that, and obviously reach out to any of us here. The team is here to serve. So we like to think of ourselves as responsible as possible, because at the end of the day, we're about helping to serve and help inform others who do the same.
Awesome. And for listeners, I've been taking notes. These are all going to be in the show notes. So if you go to beyondtheuniform.org, you'll find Nick's interview, and in the show notes, you'll find links to all of those you just mentioned: America Serves, Hiring Our Heroes, Onward Opportunity, all of them. Well, I know that we're towards the end of our time. I always like to leave the last question open-ended, and that is, what have we not covered that you want to leave with listeners, or what would you like to impart to them as we wrap up?
Oh, I mean, I would circle back to our start at the top. I think, I just encourage folks that, in transitioning from military service, like it's about finding your purpose. There are all kinds of organizations out there that are willing to help. Another one that I didn't mention at the top, but I've been a part of from the very beginning was Team Red, White, and Blue. That was another great organization that, just being part of the early startup days, helping to stand a chapter up here in Syracuse. I think that was big for me in terms of helping to also find that purpose. But there are folks, who've kind of been there and are willing to help. Please reach out to us, check our programs out, and if there's any way we can be helpful, whether you're part of the military community or you're a service provider or someone else who's trying to, help advance the lives of the military community. We just like to think that we're here to help. So just a pleasure to be with you here, Justin.
That's great. And also for listeners, with Team Red, White, and Blue, in episode 108, I spoke with Garrett Cathcart as part of their team to talk about that. It's a great organization, and I'll have a link to that episode as well in case you want to take a deeper dive. Well, Nick, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, and really appreciate the work that you're doing and that data-driven approach. I know that the impact you're having is massive in terms of the number of veterans growing through your programs, but I just love how you're at the forefront right now of doing this research that's going to help us better understand how to make military veterans succeed and thrive in their civilian career.
Surface, surface, surface.
Well, thank you so much for listening and for supporting Beyond the Uniform. Beyond the Uniform is produced and edited by me, Justin Asiri. Our staff is entirely part-time. They do this on nights and weekends out of the goodness of their hearts to give back to the military community. Our director of outreach is Steve Bain, who relentlessly books guests, finds sponsors, puts together our newsletter, and thousands of other critical tasks every single week, all behind the scenes to keep Beyond the Uniform running smoothly. Our editor is Kathleen Dillon, who listens to and transcribes every single episode to help out those who don't have the time to listen to the show. It has a major impact on our site's SEO value, which helps people find us through Google. Our data analytics and insights advisor is Andrew Woolridge, who pours over the data each and every month to help us better understand how to best serve the Beyond the Uniform audience. Our digital production work is done by Michael Cummings, who puts together custom artwork for every episode. If you're enjoying Beyond the Uniform, the best way to help us out is by telling your friends and fellow service members and veterans. iTunes reviews, believe it or not, have a big impact on getting the word out as well. So if you have a chance to leave a positive review, that is greatly appreciated. If you know of a business that would like to get their product or service in front of a military audience, we are always on the lookout for sponsors, which helps us subsidize the cost of putting this show together. And if you haven't yet signed up for our newsletter, you can do so at beyondtheuniform.io. We send out a newsletter twice a month, and it is a treasure trove of helpful information for your civilian career and transition. And be sure to check out our coaching program, where you can be connected with a subsidized professional, certified executive and career coach to help you in your career decision making. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back next week with more stories from military veterans about their civilian career. Take care.